You're listening to the Weekly Sermon Podcast from Trinity Church Denver. To find out more about Trinity, visit our website at trinitychurchdenver.org. And be sure to subscribe to this podcast in your favorite podcast player to get the latest episodes as soon as they're available. And now, please enjoy the sermon.
The other night, Friday night at about 9 p.m., our doorbell rang, and standing at the door was a man on one of those, and I say all of these words very instructively, a man standing on one of those edge scooter things. You know, you just stand on them and you lean forward and they push you forward and back. One of those things. And he was from Florida. And it was 9 o'clock at night. And he was there to sell me a security system for my home. At 9 o'clock at night. And he was from Florida. And he was on one of those push scooter things. Razor edge deals. I just want to keep referring to them because I wanted to mock him for having it. And I kind of wanted it all at the same time. And so as he was standing there on his mock scooter thing, he began his sales pitch. And he was very good at giving his sales pitch because anybody who at 9 o'clock at night can get me to have a long conversation, a pretty lengthy 30, 40-minute conversation about security systems is got to be a decent salesman because I didn't want to be standing on my porch at 9 o'clock at night. But truth be told, it was largely the scooter thing. And so if, just a quick aside, if you don't take anything else from the sermon, if you're in sales, get one of those scooter things and just stand on it the whole time you're trying to sell. And whoever's talking to you won't care about what you're saying, but they'll watch you on your scooter thing the whole time. And so as he was talking about security systems, a great portion of his talk was about the danger of living in the city and the real dangers that we should be afraid of and why we need to have security systems in our home because the security system will help keep you safe. And if like you're out on a date with your wife and all of a sudden the security thing is tripped, then it will call the police for you and you don't have to come home to a scary situation. And it was trying to sell me on the fear of what it is to live in the city, in our home, and why there needs to be fear, which will then lead me to buy a $500 deal, which then lead me to subscribe to a security thing and have this stuff installed for like $50 a month. And just for $50 a month, you can have peace of mind and be safe and not be afraid. Now, here's the problem with that sales pitch in our day. I was sitting there, and I was actually having a philosophical conversation with myself in the head as he was talking about these things, and it struck me that like I have zero fear of living in the city. And I know that there are people who struggle with anxiety and fears and what could happen and those kinds of things, and I don't want to make light of that, but we live in a day and age. I was trying to figure out, why do I have zero fear that I'm going to come home and my house will be invaded or on fire or someone will be stealing things? It's not because of my girth. I think it's because of this, because I begin to think like, you know, I just watched the movie Quiet Place a couple weeks ago, and there were these like monster things that ate you if you talked. And it just struck me that like I feel no fear about a human burglar because I'm constantly watching movies or shows or TV about monsters that kill you if you talk. Why would I be afraid of just like a guy with a knife? I mean, there's just no sense of fear. And it struck me as I was considering this sermon, I was considering why on earth I had no felt need for a $500 security system in our home. It struck me that like we live in a day and age in which we are inundated with stories. Stories that kind of heighten our, that we watch to kind of play with our minds to feel afraid. And so we watch a scary movie about monsters that eat you if you talk. I strongly recommend A Quiet Place, by the way. Or if we want to feel something beautiful or glorious, we watch a movie like Dunkirk and we see kind of this heroism played out on a grand scale. And so we're constantly surrounded by images and narratives and stories played out on sometimes on giant screens that kind of immerse you in sound that's surrounding you, that immerse you in this in real kind of emotional weight around false stories. And it becomes really, really hard then when you step out of those narratives to kind of step into a world and feel fear and feel grandeur and feel majesty. For us to appropriately come to terms with a world that is filled with majesty and filled with monsters and filled with danger and filled with glory. Because we've numbed our ability to take in the realities of the world that we're surrounded with. One of the gifts that the book of Revelation is to us as the people of God is it is God's work to kind of take normal reality, to take everyday occurrences around us and to fill them with majesty, to fill them with weight, with glory, with terror. To describe, for instance, a few weeks ago, to describe Nero, who appears to be just an emperor like any other emperor, just the next political leader, but to not just describe him as the next political leader, but to describe him as a beast that's arisen out of the sea that comes to devour people. I mean, this is what the book of Revelation does. And we come now to a series of chapters that in some of the starkest language possible is going to describe for us both events that are occurring kind of in that 64 to 70 AD and is describing for us the nature of the reality in which we live today. And it's attempting to do so in terms, in language, in images that are meant to call you out of kind of the mundane, everyday ways of looking at the world and to be struck by the realities in which we live. And my fear is that as we come today and begin to look at this chapter, a chapter that John Steinbeck used, it's a famous chapter in terms of the images that are used, is that we'll show up here numb. And my prayer, my thought is that God actually wants to do the opposite with us today. He wants us to feel the weight of this text in ways that honestly should make all of us uncomfortable. And so if you're looking for just discomfort, and this is the place to be for the next few weeks, we're just going to head straight into the belly of the beast, literally. And so I want to look at this text and just kind of remind you where we come from, because it's important as we head into this chapter, which functions as kind of this hinge point for the book. Like we've had this narrative kind of flowing out of chapter 12 with the dragon. Last week we looked at this kind of division that takes place in humanity. You have on the one hand those who are marked by what was called the mark of the beast, this strange number that movies are made about, 666. And we looked at the fact that that what you have in this number is a symbol of one, the number 3, which is this idea of completeness, and the number of 6, which is incompleteness. And so you have this whole division of humanity whose mark on their forehead is that they are completely incomplete. It is a vast swath of humanity that will never find rest. And to be marked on your forehead means this is your identity. This is who you belong to. This is what marks your life all the way down. And what marks humanity is not some sort of creepy number that's a secret code that if you say it in the right way, some sort of a monster will appear in your bedroom. No, it is far more terrifying than that. It is that a vast portion of humanity, the portion of humanity that refuses to worship the Lamb, that refuses to receive the gospel, lives a life of complete incompleteness, a life of wandering, a life of never finding rest, of never finding home, always looking but never arriving, always on a journey but never finding the place where rest is to be sure. And contrasted with that part of humanity was the 144,000. And what marks their life, what marks their forehead, and what was written on them is the name of the Lamb and the name of the Father. That this people that John describes as singing throughout eternity, giving thanks to the one who's redeemed them and saved them, they are those who have found rest. They are defined by rest. They are defined as those who have found their home in the Lamb and with the Father. And that great division marks all of humanity, and it marks humanity in the first century. And so with that kind of hanging in the air, John continues this transition, and the transition is going to take place here in chapter 14 with two different things happening. The first thing that's going to happen is we're going to have three angels declaring a message. It's a message that's called the eternal gospel, a gospel that's proclaimed over all of the earth, to all the nations of the earth. And it's it is eternal, so it goes on forever and ever and ever, always proclaimed. And two, it is universal. It is a gospel that is proclaimed to every single corner of the earth. And so the first part of chapter 14 that we're going to look at, this transition, is this announcement that is just occurring, that is going out. And then the second thing we're going to look at is that as that announcement is going forward, as that announcement is being carried out and proclaimed, that there is a harvest taking place. And so we're going to look at first, what is this announcement And then we're going to come back and then complete the chapter by looking at this harvest that's taking place and try to ask some questions about what this harvest is. I mean, on the way, we're going to run into some uncomfortable things. And so the first is this is an eternal gospel. And when we hear the word gospel, we hear this intrinsic to it is the announcement of good news. And so the gospel is we at the center of who we long to be as a community, as a church, as people, a people who are shaped and formed and defined by the gospel. And so if any word should kind of resonate and make us feel comfortable and say, hey, I know what that is, and I know what that should sound like, it's this word gospel. But I want us to notice the kind of the three parts of the gospel that these three angels proclaim. And so the first part, I got to find my way back to 14. The first angel proclaims with a loud voice this, fear God and give him glory, because the hour of his judgment has come, and worship him who made heaven and earth, the sea and the springs of water. And so the first part of this three-part proclamation is a command. A command that we're to fear God, a command that we're to worship God. It is a command that goes out over all of the earth, to all of those who have been marked by the beast, to all of humanity, to everyone, saying essentially at its heart, come home. Come and worship God. Come and find your home in him. Worship him, fear him, tremble before him, give glory to him. And this is the call that has gone out from the very, very beginning and continues and is made possible by the life, death, and resurrection of Jesus. That Jesus has atoned for our sins. He's done away with every barrier that would keep us from coming to the Father, to worship the Father and being welcomed back, to know this God, to love this God, and to give glory to this God. And so for age upon age upon age, an announcement has gone forth. It's gone forth from pulpits and churches. It goes out from street corners. It goes out, and even not out of the lips of men. It goes out, and as all creation commands, as Paul tells us in Romans 1, issuing this command again and again and again, worship God, give him glory. Worship God, give him glory. Worship God, give him glory. It is a call to turn from every other God. It is a call to turn from everything else that we give our worship to, that we give our allegiance to come and give all glory to God. But that command that goes over all the earth is grounded in warning. It's grounded in a warning that says, for the day of his judgment has come. And this is not a way that we often talk about the gospel anymore. Now, when I was growing up, this was the way that my grandmother talked about the gospel. She was kind of an old school missionary. So she would talk about the judgment of God. She would talk about the wrath of God. And then she would talk about, because that's coming, and therefore repent. Therefore believe in Jesus and worship God. But it's not a way that we often talk about the nature of Christianity. But it is the way that John is talking about Christianity in this chapter. You see, we like to talk about Christianity as a helpful thing. You see, we've gravitated away from the scriptures and the way that the Bible teaches about warning and about judgment and about wrath. And instead, we've drifted to ways of talking about Christianity as it's helpful to your marriage. So here's three steps to a healthy marriage, or four steps to better raising your children, or here's five ways that following Jesus can help you with your job. And I don't want you to misunderstand me. I think all of those things are true. I don't know that there's anything been more helpful and life-giving to our marriage than diving deep together into thinking about how does the gospel and how does the relationship between Jesus and his church, how does that shape and give definition to marriage and how Jenny and I relate to one another? There's been nothing more helpful to me in thinking about what does it mean to be a dad? What does it mean to raise a daughter? Than to know the love of God and to consider what God is like as he loves his children. What's fascinating to me is that when John, over and over and over again, and this happens throughout the New Testament, but when preachers of the gospel call people to be reconciled to God, when they call them to believe in Jesus, They don't start with your marriage or your kids. They don't start with, here's all the ways that Christianity can be helpful to you. It starts with a message that, if I can just be honest for a second, it's a message I'm really uncomfortable with because it's embarrassing. It starts with a message to you and to our neighbors that is, fear God and worship him, for he comes to judge the earth. Flee from the wrath to come. Judgment is coming. Worship him. This isn't a message that's popular in our day. I love to talk about the love of God. It is glorious. But when I'm thinking about how to portray what God is like to people, I gravitate to places like Ephesians 3. It talks about the height and the depth and the richness of God's love that fills the earth, this love that we can barely even comprehend. I love to talk about the meekness and the mercy and the kindness of Jesus. I even love to go to places like Revelation 4 or 5 that talk about just the sheer beauty and immensity of the grandeur of the glory of God. Like, we live in Colorado, right? So people here love beauty and grandeur and mountains and big cliffs and stunning things. And so I love to go to places like that to talk about what God is like. And yet we come again and again to these places in Scripture. And today is one of them. Where, while all of those things are true, none of those things are held up here. The eternal gospel proclaimed by these three angels is, fear God and worship him, for the day of his judgment has come. The second two angels simply expand upon that first theme. The second angel announces that fallen is Babylon the Great. She who made all nations drink the wine of the passion of her sexual immorality. This is kind of part of this turn that's happening once you get to chapter 14. As John begins to describe for these churches, the things that are about to take place, that are about to unfold in front of them as God wages war through Rome against Jerusalem. And we'll get into some of the specifics, but these Judaizers that we've been talking about that have gone and begun to partner with Rome to kind of wage war on the church in all of these different cities, the kind of suffering these churches are about to endure, some of them already endured, largely at the hands of this kind of collusion between Rome and Jerusalem. And the announcement that is announced as kind of unfolding, what does this judgment look like? Well, on one hand, it looks like Jerusalem herself, this great Babylon, this city that is, he describes as being marked by sexual immorality. And that's not, I don't think, primarily to be understood as sex, but primarily to be understood as this idea that runs throughout the whole of the Old Testament. When God, when he begins to bring indictments against his covenant people, the metaphor that he often uses is that of spiritual adultery. Of sexual immorality. And this dominates the whole book of Ezekiel, that God, with his people, is married to them. He is bound to them. And she, God's people, have been unfaithful to her. They've worshipped other gods. They've chased after their own agenda rather than the agenda of God and his kingdom. And in doing so, they've committed adultery. And so the second angel comes and proclaims that the fulfillment of this day of judgment, one of the ways that's going to be fulfilled, which we're going to dive into immense detail in the next few weeks, is the destruction of this city, Jerusalem. And then this third angel kind of spreads this judgment, not just to the city of Jerusalem, not just to that corner of where things are, but also to all those who have the mark of the beast. All those who have refused to worship the Lamb and instead have worshiped at the feet of anything other than Jesus, anything other than the God who created the heavens and the earth. And note, going back to last week, and what it means to be those kinds of people, the nature of their judgment, the nature of the wrath of God falling on them, is described as them drinking the full cup of God's wrath. That'll be important in a few verses. But second, it's also described as them never finding rest. One of the most horrible ways that God that the Bible and God through the Bible describes the nature of his wrath and judgment is not as like this kind of divine spanking where you're kind of getting prodded by pitchforks for all of eternity. That's not ever the description of God's judgment. It is you being left to your own kind of inward bending, never finding what you were made to find. Wandering forever and ever and ever and ever and ever and ever and ever. With an itch you cannot scratch, with a longing that you cannot find satisfied. I lived with a coke addict for about 4 months. And to describe his life as a living hell would not be overstatement. He longed for an experience, for a feeling, for a hit, for a thing that he could never find fulfillment. No matter how many lines he did. His life was one spent wandering and ultimately ended in his death. This is the judgment of God. For you to be handed over to your deepest desires, never fulfilled. And so the call goes out over all the earth and over this room. Fear God and give him glory. Find your home in him. For the day of judgment is coming. And so this announcement goes out. And at the center of kind of these two movements, this first, this announcement from these three angels, and then what we're going to look at next with this harvest, is this this kind of central call that runs. It actually occurred in chapter 13, and it's repeated here. And I think it's repeated here because this is kind of we've arrived now literally at the very center of the book of Revelation. And I think as you read the book of Revelation, it's all leading up to, if you want the kind of pastoral point for the book of Revelation, it is this. Here is a call for the perseverance or the endurance of the people of God. As you will remember, he's writing to these seven churches. And these seven churches are in various states of disarray. Some of them have faced enormous persecution. They've already seen family members dragged off, thrown into prison. Most of them have experienced some degree of kind of economic persecution. They're not allowed to participate in the full life and vibrancy of the city. All of them are being tempted in one of two directions, to either compromise with Judaism by stop talking about Jesus so much and just kind of take on this outward form of religion so they can kind of hide in that part of the city and not face persecution. Or we can talk about Jesus so long as we participate in all the other kind of religious life of the city. We kind of pay homage to the emperor. We participate in the kind of the sexual life of the city. We bless and ordain everything else that's happening in the cities in which we live. And so all of them are faced by those two temptations under enormous pressure to move one of those two directions because increasingly, there's pressure put on them that they can't stay where they are. And this call at the center of the book of Revelation is endure, 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 endure. And as we move into the second section, I want to just help us to think about something kind of imaginatively for a moment. Because I think it's important that we hear John and we see these images the way that the first century, these churches might have. So imagine with me for a moment, it's around November or December, and it's 64 AD. The guy in power is a guy named Nero, and you're just let's make you a flower salesman. I looked at Hannah as I said that. I'm not sure why, because you strike me as a flower salesman. So you want to run a little flower shop in your little town of Ephesus, and you're going to sell your flowers, but you've come to believe this story about this Jewish Messiah named Jesus, this Jewish king named Jesus, and you want to follow him, you want to worship him, and so you gather with the church once a week. There's probably like 30 or 40 of you at this point. You gather in different homes kind of scattered throughout the city, and you eat a meal, and over the course of that meal, you stop, and you break bread, and you drink wine, and you remember together the body and the blood of Jesus spilled for you, and there's arising in the city kind of this certain amount of pressure. You're not totally trusted, because you don't go to the temple, the temples throughout the city and worship and worship there. You don't make sacrifices there. You don't go and sleep with the temple prostitutes and the kind of the Jewish community in the city. So people don't know what to do with you. You sound like a Jewish sect, so maybe you're a Jew, but you don't really do what the Jews do. You don't you eat bacon, which is a blessing. That's why people still want to come to your house. You don't worship on Saturday. You worship on Sunday. There's all kinds of differences between you, so you don't really fit. And so people in your city don't quite know how to classify you and how to think about you. And then news begins to spread that there's been a fire in Rome, a really bad fire. Like lots of people killed in this fire. Enormous damage done. Almost the whole city was laid waste. And then a story begins to circulate from town to town to town that these group of people, this sect, this people that refuse to pledge allegiance to Rome and to the emperor, this people that doesn't quite fit with the Jews, which we kind of know what to do with them, rather this kind of sect of people who gather for love feasts and they don't go to the temple and they don't do all the things that that everybody else in our town does, that they had something to do with this fire. And then it begins to spread that actually the Christians in Rome, they started the fire because they hate Rome and they want to see Rome burn to the ground. And thousands of people died and children died. And Rome, the pride of the empire was destroyed. And Nero recognizes this and he sends an announcement to all the four corners of the earth, to all the cities in the empire, announcing these Christians, these betrayers of Rome, these haters of the gods, this sect of people who worship another god, we think they're like atheists, they're actually at fault. They've tried to start a revolt against Rome, and watch out, they may try to kill you. Therefore, they're to be arrested. They're to be fed to lions. They're to be impaled on sticks. They're to be crucified. But we're merciful, so we're going to give them an opportunity. If they'll just renounce faith in Jesus, if they'll just show their allegiance to Rome, that they're not like those fanatics who started the fire in Rome. No, they're kind of more balanced. Maybe they can talk about Jesus, but in the end, they need to worship the emperor. They need to make some homage to the emperor. They need to show up in the temple cults. They need to participate in the life of our city. If they'll do that, we'll let them live. Otherwise, arrest them, torture them, kill their families, and kill them. And into that scenario, between 64 and 67 AD, tens of thousands of Christians are killed. And you're sitting in Ephesus trying to sell flowers, and suddenly your neighbor thinks you're murderous. You're going to set fire to Ephesus. I mean, aren't you the people that started a riot a few years ago anyway? And John speaks a word and says, endure, endure, endure. And then he sends a strange story about a harvest. And this story of the harvest is meant to kind of help you understand what's happening all around you, what's happening during, to re-understand this, this as your neighbors are arrested, as you're watching your families killed, what's actually happening? What is God up to? Is Nero winning? Is the beast conquering? Well, John's answer is to say no. And so I want to ask two questions and we'll be done. One, who's being harvested? And two, what's being done with their deaths? So it's grown popular to see that the harvest here at the end is, it's a harvest of judgment. And so God is coming, he's sending Jesus to harvest all of the evil people out of the world, and then he's going to crush them like grapes. And kind of image kind of works, right? There's a number of reasons text to understand that this is not actually what this is describing. What this is actually describing is a harvest of faithful Christians. This is describing the martyrs being gathered by God. Couple reasons. I don't have a ton of time to dive all the way into why this is. But the first is he names the second harvest as a harvest of grapes. The first harvest, commonly, that was the harvest of grain. And so the very first thing that we see is that this is a harvest of bread and wine. That bread and wine is never a sign of judgment. It's always a sign of a mark of God's people, the people of the body that belongs to God. Second, as we begin to get into what happens in the next few chapters, is those who are under judgment are forced to drink the wine of God's wrath. It doesn't make sense to say that they're drinking themselves. One of the things that's going to happen is that there are going to be seven bowls that appear in the next few chapters, and these bowls are filled with the wine that's being made in chapter 14. And that wine is being poured out on the earth. And those who refuse to worship the Lamb, those who refuse to flee from judgment, are forced to drink that. So it's probably not the blood of those who are facing judgment. It's the blood of somebody else. This chapter is shot through with images from Genesis 4 and the death of Abel at the hands of Cain. This blood that is poured out on the earth. And God accuses Cain and says, your brother's blood cries out from the earth against you. And so here's who I think is being harvested. This is the martyrs that are going to die between 64 and 67 AD. It is those who are remaining faithful and enduring and crying out to and naming Jesus, even at the cost of their own lives, at the cost of their own suffering, at the cost of their own families. And John is saying right here in the middle, endure, endure, endure. You will be gathered in over the next few years. God himself comes to gather you to himself. And your blood, your death, your suffering will be the thing that God turns around and wields to bring about the judgment that's going to fall in the years following. He is gathering the suffering of God's people, the faithful, enduring suffering of God's people, and he is going to wield it over the years after this, and then by extension, even into this age, wield it for the judgment of the world. And the making of all things right and good and new again. So what do we do with all this? It's like two sermons in this text, right? Here's the first thing I think just want to hold out to you from this text. I don't know what kind of suffering you're enduring now, what kind of suffering you have endured. But if God can take the blood of martyrs and wield it, he can take whatever pain is in your life and use it. It is not in vain. The promise at the heart of this text is God is not sitting passively by as these men and women are killed. He's not sitting passively by as you endure pain and disappointment and struggle upon struggle upon struggle. No, he is wielding it. He is gathering every single drop of it for his purposes. We're going to see that unfold in the first century as it's played out historically, but I would hold that it is a truth. This is the nature and character of a sovereign God who has ordained that he will wield every ounce of your pain for your good and for the good of the world. And sometimes in the middle of that pain, all you can do is endure. And I count it as precious. That is precisely what John calls the church to do in this chapter. Endure, 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 endure. And the last thing before we take communion, what else do you do with all this? There is at the heart of the gospel just a simple proclamation that judgment is coming. All of the pain of the world, all of the sin and injustice and degradation, all of the ignoring of God and rebellion against God and hatred of God and hatred of God's people, all of that is coming to a point. and an eternal gospel goes out, an announcement still proclaimed today. Fear God and worship him, for judgment is coming. You see, we don't serve a God who's just angry. We serve a God who has made a way for all of us to come home to him. A God who came, and Jesus came, and he endured that judgment in our place. And every week we come to this table, and you come forward, and you tear off a piece of bread. That tearing is meant to remind you, in even the process of that physical act, is to remind you that someone else has borne judgment in your place. You're to dip the bread in wine, wine that has been poured out as a reminder that someone else's blood was spilled, so that the command, come and worship God, is not vainly sent out to those under judgment, to those who will trust in Jesus, those who will believe in Jesus, those who will worship the Lamb, don't have to face judgment, but that you might come and find home, that you might come and find rest. You might come and find mercy and grace, and not just the absence of judgment. But as we see moving through this book, a God who delights in you and sings over you to do you good. But judgment is coming. Fear God and worship him. Let's pray.